Retired Army Colonel and New York Times best-selling author Andrew Bacevich is this hour's speaker. In his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, Bacevich provides a searing reassessment of U.S. military policy in the Middle East over the past four decades. He spoke at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum on October 22, 2016, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival. First, we hear from Fred Wade, chair of the Madison Institute.
Our speaker today is Andrew Bacevich. He graduated from West Point, earned his PhD from Princeton University. He served in the military in the United States Army for 23 years, retiring with the rank of colonel, served in Vietnam, in the Persian Gulf, and in Germany. Since his retirement, he has taught at West Point, Johns Hopkins University, and since 1998 until recently at the Boston University in Boston. He has written, a total of 8 books, at least 3 of which have made the New York Times bestseller list: Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, which argues, among other things, that we've undertaken a number of actions in the Middle East with the expectation of promoting peace and stability, but have had results that produce just the opposite. Please welcome Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thanks very much for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to come and participate in the book festival. This is a very flattering turnout. The purpose, the naked purpose of the talk is to persuade you to take a look at my book. It's getting close to Christmas time. You all have grandchildren. I hope you have many grandchildren who are readers. But let me jump into the text quickly so that we have time for questions and discussion, which you will enjoy more than anything I have to say anyway. I have been spending a considerable amount of time of late trying to promote this book, and just about everywhere I go when we get to the Q&A after my presentation, somebody will say, "Okay, smart guy, so what do you recommend we do about ISIS?" And in some respects, the purpose of my book is to suggest that this is precisely the wrong question. And I'm reminded a little bit of the situation that we Americans faced back in late 1967 and early 1968. Some of you are old enough to remember this, when the question of the moment was this one: can Khaesan hold? And some of you, elders like me, remember that Khaesan was a Marine garrison located in the very northern part of South Vietnam. And 2 North Vietnamese Army divisions had surrounded the Marines, who were greatly outnumbered. Press commentary at that time drew fevered comparisons to another battle, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, back in 1954. Then, in 54, a besieged and outnumbered French garrison had fallen to the Viet Minh, and that defeat had decided the outcome of the French Indochina War. Was history about to repeat itself at Khaesan, with defeat there spelling the collapse of the American project in Vietnam? That's what everybody was worried about. Well, good news and bad news. The good news is that in the event, the Marines did hold. And the bad news is the United States lost the war anyway. So in retrospect, it seems pretty clear that back in late 1967 and early 1968, we were asking the wrong questions. Rather than focusing on the fate of one particular besieged garrison, the American public should have been asking questions like these: is the Vietnam War winnable? Does the Vietnam War even make sense? And if not, why are we there? Perhaps most of all, does no alternative exist to simply pressing on with a policy that even then showed very few signs of success. And I believe that today we find ourselves in a comparable situation. What to do about ISIS is a non-trivial question, but it is of far less significance than others that have for too long been largely ignored. Does waging war across a large swath of the Islamic world make sense? And if not, why do we persist in such a misguided enterprise? And again, perhaps more important than anything else, is there no alternative to simply blundering on? So the purpose of my book, and in many respects the purpose of the talk, is to call attention to these more fundamental questions. I want to suggest that answering the ISIS question today requires that we first consider how we got to where we are today, which necessarily requires evaluating what prior U.S. military efforts in this region of the world have yielded and at what cost. So my book tells the story of what has become now a decades-long military effort, a war for the greater Middle East, that began in 1980 and is still underway today. Well, why cite 1980 as a start point? Because in January of that year, President Jimmy Carter, of all people, used the occasion of his State of the Union address to designate the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest, in effect, a place that the United States now considered worth fighting for. You know, we've been fighting in the Middle East for so long now, I think most of us have forgotten that prior to 1980, the Middle East wasn't a place we were prepared or willing to fight for. Prior to 1980, we certainly were prepared and willing to fight for Western Europe. Since the end of World War II, the United States had maintained very substantial forces in Western Europe to contain and, if need be, to fight against the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact. In the wake of World War II, we had fought two very substantial wars in the Asia Pacific, one in Korea, one in Vietnam, and indeed we're continued to be prepared to wage wars in the Asia Pacific, maintaining very substantial forces there as well. But prior to 1980, the U.S. military presence in the Middle East was trivial. Prior to 1980, there were no substantial plans, there were no substantial capabilities to permit large-scale U.S. military intervention in the Islamic world. As of 1980, all that begins to change. So this Carter Doctrine, that's what Carter's statement of January 1980 came to be called, this Carter Doctrine touched off the process of militarizing U.S. policy, militarizing it not only in the Persian Gulf that he had specifically referred to, but militarizing U.S. policy across much of the Islamic world, landing the United States in a state of, in essence, open-ended war. So over the course of the subsequent 3.5 decades, and still counting, a nation priding itself in having the world's greatest military, I would certainly subscribe to the claim that we have the world's greatest military, no question about it in my mind, but we have misused that military on an epic scale. It's not simply that we have not prevailed, although obviously we've not prevailed. Rather, it's that through a combination of naivete, short-sightedness, and hubris, we have managed to make matters worse at very considerable cost to ourselves, at even greater cost to others. Well, what has this war been about? In a narrow sense, it began as a war for oil. Yet even from the outset, I've come to believe, much more was at stake than ensuring access to the cheap gas that, whether we like it or not, fuels the American way of life. From day one, the larger purpose of America's war for the greater Middle East has been to affirm that we are a people to whom limits do not apply. Throughout a war that now extends well into the 21st century, the United States has sought to validate or affirm the apparent outcome of the 20th century, widely known as the American century. As enshrined in our collective memory, maybe not yours specifically, but in the collective memory of many of our fellow citizens, That outcome, the outcome of the 20th century, testifies to American global preeminence, political, military, economic, and perhaps all, above all, ideological. That outcome also asserts a claim to privileges, above all, to freedom, abundance, and security. These define our birthright. So at least most Americans have come to believe. Well, starting with the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan, both occurring in 1979, a year before the Carter Doctrine, events in the greater Middle East have challenged such expectations. And following in their wake came a series of other developments, not least of all the 9/11 attacks, suggesting that the so-called American century might have been a fluke, or worse still, a fiction. So the ultimate purpose of our war for the greater Middle East has been to refute any such suspicions. A demonstration of American military prowess extending the American century into the indefinite future. Nominally, to listen to our political leaders at least, the U.S. troops dispatched to invade, occupy, garrison, bomb, or raid various parts of the Islamic world since 1980 have sought to punish the wicked, protect the innocent, and spread liberal values. Their advertised purpose has been to liberate, defend, or deter. Yet their actual purpose has been far more ambitious. The real mission has been to sustain claims to American exceptionalism that have long since become central to our self-identity, to bring into compliance with American purposes the revolutionaries, warlords, terrorists, despots, or bad actors of various stripe given to defiance. To employ Washington-style jargon, back in 1980, the United States set out in willy-nilly fashion to shape the greater Middle East. Now, given the conditions existing in that part of the world, employing military means to bring the region into conformity with American purposes has resulted in an undertaking of breathtaking scope. Over time, it has found U.S. forces in action everywhere from Iran and Iraq, Libya and Lebanon, Somalia and Sudan, Bosnia and Kosovo, Afghanistan and Pakistan. The list goes on. As of, 10 days ago, we can now add Yemen to the list of the places that we have attacked. Along the way, we tried overwhelming force and shock and awe. We invaded, occupied, and took a stab at nation building. We experimented with counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, regime change and decapitation, peacekeeping and humanitarian intervention, retaliatory strikes and preventive attack, even something called air occupation. That's what the U.S. Air Force styled its daily patrolling of the northern and southern no-fly zones over Iraq during the entire decade of the 1990s. Unfortunately, no administration has ever devised a plausible strategy for actually achieving American aims. Each in turn has simply reacted to situations it confronted. Nor, ironically, has any administration made available the means needed to make good on the grandiose ambitions it entertained. Indeed, on the U.S. side, one of this conflict's abiding qualities has been its paltriness. On the home front, throughout, normalcy has prevailed. You know, back when the siege of Khe Sanh was in progress, U.S. forces in South Vietnam numbered somewhere around 520,000 to 530,000. I think that the total number of U.S. forces in Iraq topped off at about 175,000. In other words, one-third the number that we sent to Vietnam, even though ostensibly the fate of the planet was supposed to turn on how the Iraq War came out.
You're listening to Andrew Basevich speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival on his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History.
Today, who can dispute the fact that the problems besetting the greater Middle East are substantially greater than they were when substantial numbers of U.S. forces first began venturing into the region, with ISIS offering one example of the results. We may argue over the underlying sources of these problems afflicting the region, but there is no arguing that U.S. efforts to alleviate the dysfunction so much in evidence there have failed. Now, to address the situation that has faced the United States in the region, Washington, the national security establishment, had a choice, it seems to me, of two basic approaches. The first approach is to wait things out, to insulate yourself from the problem's worst effects while promoting nonviolent change from within. This approach requires patience, and it comes with no guarantee of ultimate success. With all of the usual caveats attached, Vietnam War being one of the big caveats, with all of the usual caveats attached, this is the approach that the United States took during the Cold War. The second approach is more direct. It aims to eliminate the problem through sustained and relentless military action. This approach entails less patience, but it incurs greater near-term sacrifices. And after a certain amount of shilly-shallying, it was this head-on approach that the Union adopted when it brought the Confederacy to its knees during the Civil War. In its war for the greater Middle East, the United States chose neither to contain nor to crush. Instead, it has charted a course midway in between. In effect, it chose aggravation. With politicians and generals too quick to declare victory, and with the American public too quick to throw in the towel when faced with adversity, U.S. forces rarely stayed long enough to finish the job. And I say that even recognizing that we have now stayed in Afghanistan for over 15 years, and we stayed in Iraq from 2003 to 2011 before going back for another helping. Instead of intimidating, U.S. military efforts have annoyed, incited, and generally communicated a lack of competence and resolve. And in the ultimate irony, the circumstances ostensibly making the Persian Gulf worth fighting for in the first place have ceased to pertain. If today the American way of life still depends on having access to plentiful reserves of oil and natural gas, then defending Canada and Venezuela should certainly take precedence over defending Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Even so, shorn of its initial rationale, the war for the greater Middle East continues as if on autopilot, that the ongoing enterprise may someday end, that U.S. troops will finally come home, appears so unlikely as to make that prospect unworthy of discussion, even in a presidential election year. Like the war on drugs or the war on poverty, the war for the greater Middle East has become a fixture in American life and is accepted as such. For a project that I'm working on, I have been reviewing some important presidential speeches, mostly of the Cold War era. And one of the things that struck, the other day I reread President Kennedy's famous speech at American University. And for reasons that are too hard to explain, on the same day I read President Reagan's Star Wars speech. And what's striking, what's in common to those two speeches and of any number other that we could find, presidents in justifying U.S. national security policy said that the justification was peace. The object of the exercise was peace. We need to do this, we need to do that in order to achieve peace. What is so striking to me in the rhetoric that we hear today is our would-be leaders don't talk about peace. They have no plan for peace. They have no expectations of peace. Now, maybe people like Kennedy and Reagan were sort of pulling our chain. You know, they were just sort of saying these things to make us feel good. But nonetheless, they felt an obligation to frame their policy proposals in the context of achieving peace as the ultimate exercise. Somehow or other, that objective has now vanished from our politics. Well, among the factors contributing to the lack of any serious challenge to the war's perpetuation, four stand out. One is the absence of an anti-war or anti-interventionist political party worthy of the name. The ongoing war has long since acquired a perfidious seal of bipartisan approval. Got Democratic fingerprints all over it. We got Republican fingerprints all over it. And as such, these two major parties are equally disinclined to probe too deeply into the war's origins, conduct, or prospects. A second reason for the war's perpetuation is the politicians aspiring to high office find it more expedient to support the troops, and by extension, the war, than to question the war's efficacy. So candidates in every election since 1980 have avoided anything like a serious debate over U.S. military policy in the Islamic world, and no indications exist to suggest that this election is going to be any different. True, a particular military campaign gone awry, like Somalia in 1993, or like Iraq in the aftermath of the invasion of 2003, a particular military campaign gone awry may attract attention, but never the context in which the campaign occurred. So our war for the greater Middle East awaits its Eugene McCarthy, or its George McGovern, or even its J. William Fulbright, somebody at least willing to pose the basic questions. The third reason for the war's perpetuation is that some individuals and institutions actually benefit from an armed conflict that drags on and on. Those benefits are immediate and tangible. They come in the form of profits, jobs, and campaign contributions. For the military-industrial complex and its beneficiaries, perpetual war is not necessarily bad news. Finally, however, the fourth and, in my view, the most important explanation for endless war is this. Thus far, at least, Americans themselves appear oblivious to what is occurring, policymakers having successfully insulated the public from the war's negative effects. In a fundamental sense, the war is no longer our concern. So we have come to believe.
You're listening to Andrew Bacevich speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival on his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History.
But here's the rub. In the 21st century that actually exists, not the one that we think is a continuation of an earlier era. In the 21st century that actually exists, the prerequisites of freedom, abundance, and security are changing. Geopolitically, Asia is eclipsing in importance all other regions of the world, apart perhaps from North America itself. And the emerging problem set that we confront, coping with the effects of climate change, for example, that problem set is global and will require a global response. So whether or not Americans are able to preserve the privileged position to which they are accustomed will depend on how well the United States adapts to these fresh circumstances. Amid such challenges, the challenges posed by rising China, the challenges posed by climate change, the afflictions besetting large portions of the Islamic world will undoubtedly, perhaps sadly, persist. But their relative importance to the United States as determinants of American well-being will diminish. So in this context, the war for the greater Middle East becomes a diversion that Americans can ill afford. To fancy at this point that the U.S. military possesses the capacity to shape the course of events there is an absurdity. And indulging that absurdity further serves chiefly to impede the ability of the United States to attend to more pressing concerns. Ultimately, in my personal opinion, the game that matters will play itself out here at home rather than in some far-off place like Iraq or Afghanistan. Whether the United States is able to shape the greater Middle East will matter less than whether it can reshape itself, restoring effectiveness to self-government, providing for sustainable and equitable prosperity, and extracting from a vastly diverse culture something to hold in common of greater moment than shallow digital enthusiasms and the worship of celebrity. Perpetuating the war for the greater Middle East is not enhancing American freedom, abundance, and security. If anything, it is having the opposite effect. And one day, I persist in clinging to this hope, one day the American people may awaken to this reality. Then, and only then, will the war end. When this awakening will occur, however, is impossible to say. For now, sadly, Americans remain deep in slumber. Thank you very much. So I'm happy to entertain any comments and questions. I don't know why I don't put this in the text, because I get the question every time. So the name of the book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. It is a history of what the United States has been doing with its military in the region. It is not a history of U.S. policy in the region, because there was a U.S. policy in the region prior to 1980. Indeed, it was a policy that, to some considerable extent, actually contributed to making matters more complicated and worse. Many of us would cite, for example, the 1953 coup in Iran, in which we helped the Brits overthrow the Mossadegh regime, as an example. So, no, it's not a history of everything the U.S. has ever done in the region. Yes, maybe it's incomplete, but it's intended to be a military history of what the U.S. has done. Prior to 1980, apart from, and I mentioned it briefly, apart from Eisenhower's very brief and bloodless intervention in Lebanon, we didn't have any troops go there in any significant numbers. Prior to 1980, in terms of access to bases, overflight rights and the like, there were virtually none other than the exceedingly small U.S. military presence at Bahrain in a base that we were leasing from the Royal Navy.
I'm so ignorant, I only learned the other day that Tim Kaine, as a senator, had co-sponsored with John McCain an effort to end the War Powers Act or modify it in such a way that anything that was defined as a non-state, a non-viable state, could be attacked on presidential order without consultation of Congress. Is that your understanding, and has it shaped your notion of Kaine himself as a hawkish figure? Thanks.
I'm not quite sure what you said he wishes to do, but if the issue is the War Powers Act, or more broadly, if the question has to do with the latitude permitted to the president to wage war and to work around the provisions of the Constitution, which assigned to the Congress the authority to declare war, I would say, A, this is a trend that had begun decades before what I call America's War for the Greater Middle East. We can trace its origins to the early Cold War era. You will remember, for example, that Harry Truman did not feel obliged to turn to the Congress to authorize U.S. intervention in the Korean War in the summer of 1950. So this is an inclination, and the justification for the inclination for this expansion of executive power with war-making powers was the Cold War. Despite the fact that the Cold War ended, that claim of authority persisted. And indeed then was broadened further after 9/11. There are those in the public, and my impression is some members of Congress, who are having second thoughts about this open-ended grant of authority to the president. And there's been certain gestures made. Indeed, President Obama himself has said that he would welcome a new congressional resolution authorizing him to do what he's already doing in places like Iraq and in Syria. And I think the president said that because he correctly discerned that the Congress would not have the guts to actually take up that issue and debate it. So we've got a certain amount of a political charade going on here. The bottom line is, at least as far as I can tell, there has been no serious effort to restrain the executive with regard to war-making prerogatives, and I would be amazed were there to be anytime soon.
Thank you for being with us. I heard you speak in August at the Veterans for Peace Convention in Berkeley, and I must say all of our speakers there were pretty grim. There was a lot of pessimism. I'll ask you the same thing we asked Daniel Ellsberg then. Can you give us some rays of hope? What can we do that'll turn things around right now in real life? Is there any way forward?
Well, I'm generally in the camp of the pessimists. So my belief is simply this, that as citizens, we are called upon to perform our duties as citizens in the ways that seem appropriate to us. You know, for some citizens, that means becoming involved in organizations like Veterans for Peace. For some citizens, it's standing on a street corner, you know, waving a sign. For some citizens, it's supporting one candidate against another. For some citizens, it's simply, frankly, you know, mowing your lawn and being kind to your neighbors as an example of kindness and tolerance. And I think that's what we're called upon to do. And we should undertake those things with no expectations of having any significant difference. But at least on the day we die, when we go to meet our maker, we'll be able to say, hey, I did the best I could. And I mean that quite seriously. I think that's all that one can do. And then we hope and pray that the day will come when the American people, you know, what's interesting here is it's not that the American people are so completely pacified. Actually, Americans have shown a considerable continuing capacity to get uppity. The Occupy movement would be one example. The Black Lives Matter movement would be another example. So that we know that there is a capacity for mass anger to translate into pretty powerful political activism. And what we must hope is that at some point, the sort of the mindlessness of our approach to national security policy will elicit that kind of a reaction. But as I said in my talk, I don't know when it's going to happen. You know, if the government raised our taxes every time we started to go to war with another country, there would be a response. But I sort of skipped over this part of the text. But one of the interesting things about the way the war is being managed, particularly in the post 9/11 period, is that we don't pay for these wars. You know, our taxes do not go up. And of course, because of our reliance on a so-called all-volunteer force, we don't have any personal, most of us don't have any sort of personal, direct, intimate stake in what happens in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan, because we have this professional military that we all profess to admire and should admire, but we have this professional military that shoulders the load, and therefore citizens don't. I think it's a nefarious system, but it's one that today the military itself, the larger national security apparatus, and we the people have all agreed is one that we find satisfactory. Of course, the ultimate irony is it may be satisfactory in the sense that we go about our daily lives without any interruption, but the system doesn't work. You know, it doesn't. We have a military system with a very expensive military, with a military that, in a tactical and operational sense, is probably the best the world has ever seen, and yet, and we're constantly engaged in wars, and yet, we fail time and time again to achieve our political purposes in anything like a conclusive fashion. That's what war is for. The purpose of war is to achieve your political objectives. We are always at war. We don't achieve our political objectives. And yet everybody in Washington acts as if everything's hunky-dory. And I'm afraid we, the people, are implicated in that.
Speaking of everybody in Washington, it's pretty clear that there's a consensus in the foreign policy professional community that that Barack Obama has not taken up the sufficient responsibility for the situation in Syria.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton seems to agree with this, and so does Tim Kaine. And so there's going to be a great deal of pressure towards U.S. military response in Syria of some sort. So I'm wondering, I'm asking you a question as a military person rather than as a historian, but what do you think about that, and what can be done? Can anything be done? And particularly, given the complications of the situation, how is the U.S. military likely to respond to the political people who want to get in there more deeply?
Yeah, and it's not as if I have, you know, contacts in the senior ranks of the military. I've been out of the Army longer than I was in the Army. So, you know, I just, like everybody else, I just read the papers. My guess is that the senior military leadership will resist anything that looks like large-scale on-the-ground intervention with combat forces. They will be more amenable to continuation of an air campaign. They're amenable to special operations forces. They're amenable to the U.S. forces involved in kind of a train and assist mission, as they are in Iraq, where you're having proxies actually do the fighting. That would be my sense of what the military senior leadership is, how they're going to respond if indeed a new Clinton administration wants to expand the war in Syria. I'm not sure what vital interests are at stake in Syria as far as the United States of America is concerned. I would say that, as others would say, I think it's a humanitarian catastrophe of monumental proportions. And I'm not sure that we can wash our hands and say, well, it has nothing to do with us. Gosh, where'd this thing come from? But when it comes to the question of, well, then what should we do? If we have a moral responsibility, how should we acquit the moral responsibility? I think you have to ask yourself pragmatically, how can we make a difference? I'm not persuaded that dropping more bombs does much for the Syrian people who are being dispossessed. I think Angela Merkel has the answer. You know, let them in. Provide them with sanctuary. It is really kind of amazing that Germany, let me underline that, Germany has admitted something like 1 million refugees. And I believe that the Obama administration recently sort of said, we just accomplished 10,000. Now, Obama wants to admit next year another, 65,000, something like that? He won't be president, so who knows what's going to happen. But even if it's 65,000, that number relative to our capacity to come to the assistance of people, relative to the need, relative to what others such as the Germans do, it doesn't really say too much. But the seriousness of the argument made that we have a moral responsibility. So I think that in order for some semblance of stability at some future date to be restored to that part of the world, it's going to have to occur because the parties in the region conclude that they have a common interest in stability that finds expression in them cooperating with one another to defeat the forces of instability. You know, you think about ISIS, brutal, murderers. No question about it. ISIS order of battle at this point is probably about, I was in Washington the other day, and I happened to be at an event where Peter Bergen, you know, that guy's on CNN all the time, and he follows to, I said to him from the podium, I said, how many ISIS fighters are there? He said 15 to 20,000. Okay, 15 to 20,000. Virtually no heavy weapons, no air force, no navy, no weapons of mass destruction, a shrinking resource base, no allies of any significance. You know, we're not talking about the Wehrmacht here. Well, but you laugh, but I mean, somehow it gets portrayed as if it's the Wehrmacht. And I would argue that were nations in the region to recognize that they have a transcendent interest in destroying ISIS and in suppressing other such expressions of militancy, they could do that. Now, for them to do that, they would have to set aside their profound differences on other matters. And you might say, well, that would be very, very difficult. I think it would be difficult, but I think it's at least as likely to yield success as doubling down with U.S. military intervention, which thus far has not provided any success whatsoever. And if you will indulge a certainly oversimplified historical comparison, the comparison I would invite your attention to, of course, is World War II, where the embodiment of capitalism, our team, the embodiment of European colonialism, the Brits, and Joseph Stalin's totalitarian, Marxist, Leninist, brutal, murderous empire, we set aside our differences in order to ensure the defeat of Nazi Germany. Didn't mean that the big three were going to be friends, best friends forever, right, BFFs, because the alliance fell apart as soon as Germany was defeated. But a collaboration of odd bedfellows is possible, and it seems to be the task of American diplomacy. And I'm pleased, I'm not trying to suggest this would be easily accomplished, but the task of American diplomacy is to bring nations in the region to the realization that their common interests in some respects should take precedent over their differences. And that's where I think the emphasis ought to be, rather than talking about further U.S.-led military escalation. Yeah. Okay. If you didn't hear that, why did the Soviets go into Afghanistan in 1979? The perception in Washington was that the Soviets went into Afghanistan because they were embarking upon a path of military expansionism, that they were taking advantage of the weakness of the United States post-Vietnam, the weakness of the United States with Jimmy Carter as president, to steal the march on us. That was a misperception. We now know from Soviet documents that the reason the Soviets intervened in Afghanistan was out of fear. And from their point of view, for defensive purposes, they were concerned that political instability in Afghanistan could affect other parts of the Soviet empire, in which there were substantial Muslim populations in the so-called stands. So they persuaded themselves that they needed to intervene in Afghanistan to prevent the empire from crumbling. Of course, the irony of that is the intervention in Afghanistan ended up being the act that then accelerated the disintegration of their empire. Well, I disagree with the premise of your question. I don't think that 9/11 itself provides an adequate explanation for all the turmoil and dysfunction. I think that the answer to that question, you have to go much further into the past. But what you want to know is how should we have responded? And what we should have responded is by recognizing that this Islamist terror, defining it as an international criminal conspiracy, in which the existing state system had a common interest in eliminating. It's a challenge. It's a threat to the state system. And so the instead of declaring war on terrorism, which is a goofy idea, we should have basically organized a very broad-gauged international police posse to identify and to root out the conspirators, to destroy al-Qaeda and to destroy any other like-minded organizations employing similar tactics. But it would have been a broad-based, collaborative effort rather than one where we asserted primacy and where we emphasized the application of conventional military power as the solution. And I say that now, and you might say, God, he should have been in a position of authority. The truth is, back in September 2001, I didn't say that. But there were people then who said, war on terror, stupid idea. International police effort, that's the way to go. So the alternative counsel was available. And Michael Howard, a very, very, very distinguished military historian from Great Britain, was specifically the guy who published an article in Foreign Affairs that made that point very quickly after 9/11. But he was a Brit, so what do they know?
I want to go back to the comment you made about support of troops, which has kind of become a sacramental claim here in the States. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on the rhetoric versus the reality in your engagement with current troops, whether it's in the halls of learning at West Point or people who are on the battlefield.
Yeah, I mean, I don't claim to be sort of have my finger on the pulse of the United States military, but the soldiers that I talk to, some of whom are on active duty and some are not on active duty, I think they view the support the troops rhetoric as hypocritical, as empty, as a gesture that has no particular meaning. You know, raise your hand if you have read Billy Flynn's Halftime Walk. Like two people. Is it one of the great novels of all time? You don't think so? I think it's a great novel. But I'm going to get to, it's a comic novel, a dark, dark, dark comic novel, but it gets very much to the shallowness of the support the troops posturing. It's about to come out as a movie, by the way, starring I don't know who, but it's not a long novel. It's a great novel, and if you only have enough money to buy one book, no, seriously, it's a great novel, and the author is Ben Fountain. Okay. Billy Flynn's Halftime Walk. It's very, very good on this topic.
Well, it still seems to me like the big problem causing a lot of this is religion, starting perhaps with George W. Bush's crusade to the Middle East, and now the different factions, as you said, and you think that can be worked around, but I just...
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you're right. I tried to phrase my suggestion in a way that did not in any way suggest that this would somehow be easy. And it certainly, I imagine if we were sitting in the, in a meeting with Susan Rice in the National Security Council, and if I said, oh, Dr. Rice, I got a great idea. Let's see if we can get Iran and Saudi Arabia to collaborate against ISIS. She'd, kick me out of the building because the mindset is, as I interpret it from a distance, is emphatically committed to the notion that it is only through the exercise of American global leadership that problems can be solved. We can't expect people to solve their own problems. We have to do it. And further, they are committed to the proposition that at the end of the day, leadership comes with a sting. And the sting is the United States military. And so bringing people in the policy world around to the notion that those two propositions may absolutely obstruct rather than to facilitate solving problems is difficult. I think, you know, this is slightly off the topic, but the reason that the Obama, the nuclear deal with Iran was so controversial is because it suggested a retreat from both of those propositions. And that just doesn't go down well within the foreign policy establishment. I personally believe, granting that we're a long way from knowing whether the Iran nuclear deal is going to play out the way we want it to play out, and although I have my own problems with aspects of President Obama's performance as president, I think that that was an enormously gutsy and creative initiative that, if it works out, will ensure that historians 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now will give him pretty darn high marks, because it shows that he at least, even if not the people around him, is not a prisoner to those core propositions to which the foreign policy establishment is so devoted. So I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much for turning out, and great questions.
You've been listening to Andrew Bacevich speaking on his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He spoke at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison on October 22, 2016, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival.